In just a moment, we hope to be joined by Dan Senor. In the early days of the war, he served as spokesman and senior advisor to U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer, who was then the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority. If you have questions for Dan Senor about the way ahead in Iraq, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is talk@npr.org. In the meantime, you can look ahead to news coverage later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. In Florida today, the President of the United States made a campaign appearance in Pensacola, Florida, but the Republican candidate for governor in Florida, Charlie Crist, wasn't there. In any case, that story coming up later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. Dan Senor joins us now. As we mentioned, he was a spokesman and senior advisor to U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer and the Coalition Provisional Authority. He's with us today from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you back on the program, Dan Senor.
Good to be with you.
And I wanted to begin by asking, obviously, the news of the sentence pronounced yesterday in the trial of Saddam Hussein. How do you think that is going to affect things? There were many hopes that a trial of Saddam Hussein would begin a healing process, a reconciliation, as the kind of crimes committed under his administration were revealed.
Yeah, and we certainly don't have reconciliation now, if you measure it by the degree of sectarian tension. Look. I think some sort of truth and reconciliation is crucial to some kind of stability in Iraq in the long term. And some determination, a final determination of the fate of Saddam Hussein, some justice being served, if that's possible, is central to this truth and reconciliation process. And you cannot have that justice and you cannot have that truth and reconciliation unless Saddam was dealt with in the way that it seems that he's being dealt with, but it's not sufficient in and of itself. In other words, I think people are overhyping it to some degree when they say that this is a big moment in and of itself. It's a big moment, but we need many more big moments in order to get some reconciliation between the Shiites and the Sunnis. The Shiites have been acting up in recent months, as you know. They have been empowering their militias. They've been letting their militias run wild. And it's in part because they believe the Sunnis are in ascendance and that we have never really dealt with the Ba'athists and with the Saddamist loyalists. And I think this verdict in that regard sends an important message to the Shiites that we are dealing with the regime's former leadership and their representatives.
Yet at the same time, there are many Sunnis, as you well know, who will be hailing Saddam Hussein as their leader and now a martyr.
Right, and we're already actually seeing that in some of the Sunni towns like Samarra and Bakuba, north and northwest of Baghdad. There were protests, people basically expressing their anger over this judgment. Look, I think that's going to happen for some of the Sunni communities. You are going to scratch a little bit of a scab for them, and they're going to regard this in the short term as humiliation. And look, it may even result in some more violence in the short term. I recognize that the short-term implications are complicated with a verdict like this. But as far as the long-term objective of reaching some kind of reconciliation and getting some kind of stability in that country, it would be impossible to do so if the majority community in the country, the Shiites, which make up 60% of the country, not to mention the Kurds, if they believe that Saddam and his regime was never dealt with in terms of some justice being served. So in the short term, it will aggravate the situation with the Sunnis, but in the long term, this is crucial.
Mm-hmm. As we look at the future of Iraq, obviously there's an election in this country tomorrow, and I guess a couple of weeks ago it was President Bush said he would no longer be using the term stay the course in Iraq, yet we saw in an interview on ABC News yesterday, the Vice President, Dick Cheney, said we don't make our decisions on Iraq on the basis of what's popular, we do it on the basis of what we think is right. If the American people, if tomorrow's election is perceived to be a referendum on the president and on his Iraq policies, as many people say it is, should the president and the vice president be listening?
Of course. Look, this election is going to be a referendum on Iraq. People are frustrated about Iraq. They have every right to be frustrated about Iraq. The news out of Iraq, by and large, has been bad. But what they shouldn't take away from this election, assuming it is bad for Republicans, is that this means that we should just withdraw from Iraq prematurely. Whatever one thinks about Iraq and whatever one thinks about why we got there and how we got there and whether or not we should have gone there in the first place, that doesn't tell us anything about where we go from here. And that's the question that I think the president and the vice president and the administration need to consider. They should not take away from the election the notion that we should somehow withdraw from Iraq prematurely, because we have the potential to leave behind a failed state where terrorists, radical terrorists from throughout the region could capitalize on the weakness of a failed state and use it to launch terrorist attacks, not necessarily against America per se within our borders, but certainly against our interests around the world and our interests in that region. And the implications would be enormous, not to mention even more revved up civil war than we have now. Instead of 100 Iraqis getting killed a day, we could easily have 1,000 or a few thousand Iraqi casualties a day. So I think we need to be forward looking in this regard and not backward looking. We shouldn't view this election as just simply a relitigation of why and how we got into Iraq and whether or not we should have gotten into Iraq, and therefore make quick decisions about what we should do next. Should we get out? You know, we just need to think strategically long term here and not get rattled.
There are, as you know, now many Republican critics of the way the war has been handled as well. On this program just last week as part of the series, Richard Perle was saying he thought there had been 2 years of mistakes in Iraq. As you look at the road ahead, should the people who are responsible for making some of those mistakes, if mistakes they were, should they be the ones to carry out the policy in the next 2 years?
I'm less concerned with personnel decisions than I am about policy decisions. In other words, it's the president's policy at the end of the day. And everyone who wants to say that it's this commander or this cabinet secretary or this bureaucratic official that's not doing a good job, that may or may not be true. I leave that to others to decide. What's the policy? What is our policy? And one thing, you know, we've learned a number of lessons over the last few years, and certainly my time there, I learned plenty of lessons of what will work and what won't work in Iraq. And one of the most striking things to me today in terms of the lessons we have learned, one of the most paramount, is that we have very little influence over the politics of Iraq today. Right now, you have a Shiite prime minister that is basically beholden to Muqtada al-Sadr's Mehdi army, which is a powerful militia and powerful political party within the Shiite governing coalition. We would hope that Iraq's prime minister would clamp down on Muqtada al-Sadr and some of these other Shiite militias. He hasn't. To the contrary, he's actually been an enabler for them. And what that has taught us is we don't really have much leverage over Iraq's political process. The only thing we have leverage over is our troop presence. We can make a decision about whether we want more troops, fewer troops, where we want the troops to be concentrated, how we want what we want the troops' rules of engagement to be. Those are the only things at the end of the day we can control. So mm-hmm. We can have all sorts of theoretical discussions about implementation of a political strategy, and if we can get this group to form a coalition with that group, somehow we'll get some sort of political dynamic that'll serve our interests. And I think that's disconnected from reality.
Mm. You were just talking hypothetically. At this point, do you seriously think that more troops is a political reality?
It's a good question. I question whether or not there is a political appetite in this country for sending more troops. You just look at the polling and you go talk to people, and one would think that there isn't. But I can't speak to the politics. I'm not an expert on domestic U.S. Elections this cycle. I can tell you what's going on in Iraq. In Iraq, in the parts of Iraq where we have had a low ratio between the number of Iraqi civilians and the number of U.S. troops, we have had stability. In parts of the country where we've had a high ratio, we've had chaos. And I'll give you just two data points here. In Tal Afar, which is a small town on the Iraq's western border, right along the border with Syria, we conducted an operation there about 8 to 10 months ago. And during that operation, we cleared out the insurgents and we hunkered down and secured the town. The ratio of Iraqi civilians to U.S. troops was 40-1. Up until recently, in terms of the ramped up operations in Baghdad, the ratio of Iraqi civilians to our forces in Baghdad was 700-1. You simply cannot control places like Baghdad, the capital city where almost a quarter of the country's population is, the financial capital, the political capital, the media capital of the country, with such a low level of troops. And so that I don't want to get into the debate domestically, whether or not there's political appetite for more troops. I'm just telling you that we can stabilize Iraq and we can get a real political dynamic going there if Iraq is stable. But we don't have a real political dynamic today that we can influence, and we don't have security in Iraq. And I think in large measure it's because we aren't hunkered down and concentrating our forces with sufficient numbers in places that need it.
We're talking today with Dan Senor, the spokesman and a senior advisor to U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer and the Coalition Provisional Authority, April 2003 to June 2004, about the way ahead in Iraq and our series Rethinking Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Nick on the line. Nick is with us from Beaufort, South Carolina.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hello, yes, I had a question, too, and it really, you peeled right back on me, Mr. Senor. I'm really worth trying to find out. The grievous mistakes that got us into Iraq are one thing, and then the mistakes we made once we won are quite another. The fact that we peeled off the entire civil infrastructure and fired the army so that we had a net political vacuum, what are the ratios of the number of people who were in position, Iraqis in position, to enforce civil order during the first few months, the critical months when we were trying to form a new government? You mentioned the fact that you peel a scab, and what do you find? It seems to me that now we're in the process of trying to rebuild the scar tissue from a scab that was peeled off by an administration that had no idea how a country is to be conquered. The lessons of World War II, where we used Nazi troops and the Japanese troops to maintain order after the collapse of their armies, which is a little-known fact, I think, to the administration, is an example of how disbanding the Ba'ath Party and disbanding all of the army created this vacuum.
And I'm going to give Mr. Senor a chance to respond, but we really want to talk about the way ahead in Nick and not go over the past. But go ahead, Dan Senor.
Well, you know what? It's an important question, and I think I can tie it to where we go from here. First of all, the denazification program in post-World War II Germany was far more aggressive in terms of eliminating the civilian government infrastructure than what we did in Iraq. We just removed about 1% of Iraq's government, the most senior level Ba'athists, and we didn't. If you let me finish.
Go ahead, Dan.
And if we and the army dissolved itself. We did not dissolve the army. All we did was we didn't recall the army. We didn't bring the army back to work. And both of those things we did were both of a practical nature, but they were also of a political nature. And that speaks to today. That is to say, the Shiites and the Kurds, which make up 80% of the country, which were brutally repressed by Saddam's government, brutally repressed by Saddam's army, which was the principal tool of his repression. The Shiites and the Kurds felt burned by us after the first Gulf War, particularly the Shiites. After the first Gulf War, we encouraged them to rise up against Saddam's government, and then we weren't there for them when Saddam's government beat them back down and killed a lot of them. So they were watching us quite closely, and in shutting down Saddam's regime via de-Ba'athification, via not calling back the army, we were sending a signal after this Gulf War to the Shiites and the Kurds that make up 80% of the country, that it's a new day in Iraq, that Saddam's old regime isn't going to be back, his tools of repression aren't going to be back and aren't going to be in charge. And those were crucial steps in getting the Shiites and getting the Kurds to participate with us. In fact, the Kurdish leaders were quite clear with us. They told us that had we called back Saddam's army, they would have seceded up in the north. They would have just left Iraq and formed their own country. What does that tell us about today? I think in recent months, we have bent over backwards to accommodate the Sunni leaders, to get them back into the political fold, to help them feel a greater degree of inclusiveness. And it has been at the expense of our leverage and support from the Shiite communities. And it is very important to send a message constantly to the Shiites, who always are questioning us and always questioning about whether or not we're ultimately going to cave and put a Sunni strongman back in charge, much like they suffered with Saddam. It's always important to send a message to them, and we need to do that today, and we need to do that going forward, that these Sunni Ba'athist types will not come back to power. And to the extent that the insurgency has been in ascendance, it has made it that much harder for us to convince the Shiites to clamp down on their militias, because they believe their militias, which are a big part of the problem today, are providing security where we are not and are beating back the Sunni insurgents where we are not.
And we just have a minute or so left, but let's get a question in quickly if we can from John in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Yes. There's a lot of focus in America on the Sunni-Shiite conflict, but it's also true that there's conflict within Shiites in Iran or in Iraq, between those who are supported by Iran and who support Iran and those who don't. We like to think of Muqtada al-Sadr as the, quote, anti-American cleric, but he's also an Iraqi nationalist, and he doesn't support Iranian power. Given that fact, wouldn't it be a good idea for us to try to get al-Sadr more into our camp and use him as a bulwark against Iranian influence in Iran?
And I'll give you 40 seconds to answer that, Tansino.
Yeah, well, the short answer is, unfortunately, Muqtada al-Sadr was responsible for the slaughter of a rival cleric who was very supportive of the West immediately after the end of major combat operations. Since then, he has built up a militia and a political organization in Iraq that resembles, as far as I'm concerned, every bit as much as Hezbollah operated in a failed state of Lebanon in the 1980s and over the subsequent 10 to 20 years became a real rival force and to this day wreaks havoc in Lebanon. Muqtada al-Sadr's had the same agenda. Its financial support comes from Iran. Its political organization and lessons come from Hezbollah and Iran. And I think it has the potential to be as dangerous in Iraq today and 10 years from now if it's left unchecked as Hezbollah did in Lebanon.
John, thanks very much for the call. Dan Senor, thank you for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Dan Senor served as spokesman and senior advisor to U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer, former head of the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad. He joined us today from our bureau in New York. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.